Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
Hello, dear listener, and welcome to another episode of Everyone is Hot, the podcast that talks about your favorite stealth sex symbols and the film that turned you onto them. I'm Michael Stevens.
And I'm Shelley Brooks. And Michael, would you like to introduce our very exciting guest this week?
Absolutely. We are really excited to have him here, co-host of the Hit Factory podcast, Aaron Casillas, everyone.
Hooray! Yay! Hooray! Welcome, yeah. Aaron. The children are so thrilled.
thank you all so much for having me. I wish I could say I always have just parades of children celebrating my entrance wherever I go. So it's not new to me, thankfully, but that means it won't go to my head.
That's good. Yeah, you got to keep an even keel. We did bring in all the children from the movie that we're going to be talking about. So,
oh, very good, very good.
They're quite old now. But they kept that youthful energy. Which, speaking of, Aaron, who is your stealth sex symbol this week, and what movie are we going to be talking about?
Oh, I'm excited to talk about this one. We are going to be discussing my stealth sex symbol today, Kathleen Byron, actress from the 1947 Powell and Pressburger film Black Narcissus.
Oh, I was so thrilled when you gave this as an option. This is such a great choice. And yeah, I mean, she is a beautiful actress, very very sexy, but it is an interesting stealth sex symbol because she is crazy in this
she
movie.
Is fucking unhinged in this movie.
She is terrifying.
It's the best.
Some would argue that that is what makes her sexy. Some would. I don't know if I'm going to.
Yeah, who knows who?
I mean, who?
Who could be?
Well, Michael, if someone has not seen the 1947 Powell and Pressburger film, Black Narcissus, could you tell them what it's about?
You absolutely should watch this movie immediately. It is about a group of nuns struggling to establish a convent in the Himalayas while isolation, extreme weather, altitude, and culture clashes all conspire to drive the well-intentioned missionaries mad. Now, we normally source these from IMDb. I don't think this synopsis was as bad as the ones that we get.
They can get pretty grim, but this one was actually very well done, I think.
Concise,
to the point.
To the point. 10 points for whoever the fuck this is.
Yes, and this is really an ideal Everyone is Hot title because it is a movie kind of all about going insane because you are so horny.
Yeah, I have been looking for a reason to watch this movie for a real long time, so... very glad to kick off my day with this.
Perfect. Well, before we get into our main discussion, and we'll talk a little bit about your history with the movie, Aaron, we first like to get a little slick, a little warm, and we do that with a sexy trivia game. Michael, what is the sexy trivia game?
Oh, well, very simple. Just some movie chatting about some movie trivia before we go into our full discourse. I will kick us off. Some 50 years after being afforded her career role as neurotic nun, Sister Ruth in Black Narcissus, Kathleen Byron would cameo in Les Miserables, 1998, as Mother Superior of the nunnery where Valjean and Cosette are sheltered for 10 years, a role played in Les Miserables, 1978, by Byron's Black Narcissus castmate, Flora Robson.
Oh, very good indeed. Yeah. Aaron, would you like to give us number B?
Number B, gladly. Michael Powell initially ruled that the actresses playing the nuns would not wear any lipstick on camera. However, after a couple days filming, they noticed that the Technicolor film made it look as though they were. The solution was to have the actresses wear lipstick in flesh-colored tones. Flesh-colored tones.
Ooh.
Which made their lips look more natural.
Oh my God.
What rosy lips indeed. I shall finish us off with
please do.
C.
Please do.
Kathleen Byron, Deborah Carr, and Gene Simmons appeared in Young Bess from 1953. While in Hollywood, Byron got into a taxi, and the driver recognized her as the Mad Nun. And that is the sexy trivia game.
Ooh, I like camera, a little Jenna Maroney on there. Camera.
Camera. It felt right in the moment.
It was perfect. We loved it. We loved it. Oh my goodness. I will say this was a very interesting trivia section because much like our synopses, we get these from IMDb. Sometimes they are stupid, these trivia sections. This one is actually very good. There's a lot of, you know, technical information about, you know, sort of like the matte painting and about the way that they created the production design. Though my favorite piece of trivia is the very last one that notes that towards the end of the film, Sister Ruth wears a pair of boots that look a lot like Uggs, which would later come into fashion in later decades.
Wow. Oh my goodness.
Oh, a trendsetter.
Very perceptive of that person.
Yeah. I'm sure that person was watching this movie and he was like, oh shit, I've got something great for IMDb.
Oh. I gotta get to my computer.
I'm nuts over this.
She's wearing fucking Uggs.
They went out with their friends that night and they're like, you guys are not gonna fucking believe.
What guys, I just guys, saw listen.
In this old my movie.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I'm trying to see. Let's see. I'm going to look really quickly. How many people found this interesting? 5 people found it helpful. Hey. So good job, whoever noticed the precursor to Uggs in the film.
Very good.
Well, Aaron, tell us about your background with Black Narcissus and with Kathleen Byron specifically.
Gladly. Oh my gosh. Let's see where to start here. So I saw Black Narcissus for the first time, I think, as a teenager, when I was a budding cinephile in the early days of Netflix, when you could still get DVD movies from them. And I don't know if you all like remember this period, but like the algorithm at this point was not as refined, but it was also just like in just an incredible like source for discovering like the weirdest possible shit.
Yeah.
And I'm not calling this one necessarily, you know, kind of off the beaten path or sure. or too weird, but it's the way that I came to so many filmmakers that I love today in sort of like the more like art house avant-garde space. But then saw people kind of, you know, routinely mentioning The Archers, Powell Pressburger. So I immediately rented both this and The Red Shoes.
Yes.
Yes. Which is, I mean, one of the most gorgeous movies ever put to film, as is this. It's just like these Technicolor dreams. So I watched this, probably for the first time around like 17 years old. And my relationship with it just has evolved from there. I loved it at the time. I don't know that I quite clocked all of its suggestion and subtlety because it's a very erotic movie.
Yeah.
It's a very sexy movie, very like steamy, but all of it is implication throughout.
Mm.
It's very like, you know, it's very 1940s in that way, but is kind of racy. But I've always, I think, been drawn to Sister Ruth and Kathleen Byron since I watched this. Like, I mean, Deborah Kerr is Deborah Kerr. She's beautiful. She's very charming. She's lovely in this movie. She's got like beautiful red hair, and especially in the flashback, she's just stunning. But I don't know. I like them a little crazy sometimes. I like them a little edgy. So she's just someone who I was always drawn to. And I think in this movie, the thing that, you know, makes her so special is like the versatility of her hotness.
Yeah.
Like, she looks good in the nun garb, and then she gets like a literal like horror music cue because she's so hot when she like puts on the dress for the first time.
Yeah.
And then she goes crazy at the end.
It's so funny.
And is in her like goth baddie phase a little bit.
She looks like an actual model when she's in the door frame, and like she's got like the, you know, the severe makeup, and her hair is all wet. Like, yeah. That was interesting that you know, watching it as a teenager and not catching all the sort of like subtleties of the, you know, erotic stuff. Cause I had a similar experience with the movie that I rented it from Netflix when I was in high school. Mine was because I was really into the book 1001 Movies to Watch Before You Die. And it was
I had
in there.
That book too.
Oh yeah. The teen cinephiles, you know, steady companion. But watching it this time, I don't think that I had seen it since high school actually. But I mean, I obviously recognized the overt sort of like erotic madness of it when I was a kid, but like the subtle things, like, you know, the lines about like, I appreciate you teaching the girls for me. And, you know, the line about, you know, are you going to ask, basically implying, are you going to ask if I slept with a 17-year-old girl who's been sitting on my porch? Like, I definitely did not clock those when I was, you know, 15 watching this.
Right.
But yeah, but it's interesting that that you were so drawn to this specific character. So, I mean, have you found that your feelings towards the character have shifted from watching it as a teenager to now watching it as an adult and towards the character?
That's a great question. I think yes. And, you know, especially on this last rewatch, obviously I have, at least I'd like to believe I've evolved as a person a little bit in the intervening, what is it now, like 15, 16 years? But yeah, you know, I think the film, as you watch it and like kind of take it at face value when you're a little bit younger or maybe like a little bit less entrenched in what the film is doing, you see her as like the principal antagonist of the film. And she is in a lot of ways, right? She is the one who eventually becomes kind of psychotic and murderous. But she's also the one who is the most willing to give in to the reality and the nature of the situation they find them in the film. And you can see that while the others are sort of adhering to a sense of like decorum and a sense of kind of like devotion and holiness that they're carrying from like a previous life into this very kind of exotic region, she's somebody who kind of more wholeheartedly embraces early on and recognizes sort of the gravity and magnitude of what they're facing in this new environment. She's the one who's maybe like the least delusional for a little while.
Yeah, it's funny because I had forgotten the fact that in the beginning of the film, I had sort of remembered the film as, you know, it being just that she went off the deep end once they got there. And I had forgotten the fact that, like, from the beginning that she's sent there in part because she was erratic and, you know, unsuited for that life from the beginning. Like, you know, we are introduced to her as an empty spot at the table with the nuns. But yeah, this sense of her not fitting into the strictures of like a religious life from the very beginning, I think is something very exciting about her as a character, because she seems unstable, but also like more of the world than the rest of them. So, Michael, this was your first time seeing the film. What were your initial impressions?
Well, I'm a Catholic, so absolutely. I absolutely loved it. Seeing these nuns grapple with their very sensual environment. Yeah, I loved it. I loved seeing Homegirl just lose her fucking mind this whole movie. Specifically the scene where she's confronted by Sister Clodagh about her fixation on Mr. Dean, and then there's a shot of like a close-up shot of her eyes, and she's just very I don't know, what's that horror movie with the ghost, and she's like I don't know.
Oh, the Exorcist.
Yes. Yeah,
she's shot a bit like that because it cuts to her and it sort of pans up and you see her face rise and she's like under the habit and like her eyes looking up. She shot like a horror movie villain throughout the film.
There's something very demonic and witch-like about her that scratches the Wicked Witch of the West itch that I am always talking about on this show. So, yeah, I really loved this performance and this movie overall. It made me think of a lot of other kind of movies focused on the overlap between like the natural world and eroticism. But I'll talk about that a little bit later.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned, you know, speaking to you as a Catholic, because something, again, this was one good IMDb trivia section. It got into detail about the cuts that had to be made for it to be sold in the American market to meet the censorship requirements. And I mean, one of the things was that they had to alter the title card at the beginning to say, like, to state clearly, like, they're not Catholic. These are Protestant nuns.
Oh,
and it's fascinating the scenes that had to be cut in order to, you know, appease the censors, because there's nothing, you know, over the top sexual in this or anything, but the sensuality is so palpable and so strong, even in its implication, because apparently they had to cut the scene where Sister Ruth puts on her lipstick, which, you know, it's just a close up of a woman's mouth putting on lipstick, but it is like tingling with it eroticism. Yeah. So, I mean, that, Aaron, what were some of the moments that sort of stuck out to you is like the most sort of like charged moments in the film?
Oh my God. Great question. The one that Michael mentioned, you know, that first time, well, not the first time, but you know, there's like the kind of like main confrontation between Clodagh and Ruth, where Clodagh kind of accuses Ruth for the first time of being obsessed with Dean. David Farrar's character, and you can just feel from her like the jealousy, like the just like palpable jealousy from Deborah Kerr, and that she's, you know, at once trying to be the disciplinarian and retain kind of this, you know, like, you know, dig her heels in a little bit in terms of the order and keeping things where they need to be, but also she's like fiery hot horny, like, for this guy, and is like denying it by like pointing the finger at somebody else and being like, you want to fuck this man, and like, yeah, that's bad. And she's like, what, like, look at you, like,
what? No,
like,
you,
like, you're literally vibrating right now, like,
yeah.
That one to me is just like, there's something about it too that's just, I think, like, it feels so accurate to like that sense of like sexual competition, you know, where you kind of like retaliate against somebody in ways that are petty and minor, but clearly charged with something like beyond. And that one to me is that way. Also, basically anytime David Farrar comes in and he's wearing like a 3-inch shorts. Yeah. You know, and it's just like, come in and you're ready for like a nut to like slip out the side of it when he's like sitting in a chair, like sipping tea. And it's like, you guys are just like, you're going for it. Good for you.
Though it is funny, I think that something that's interesting about the movie is that with David Farrar's character, that he obviously is like a strapping man with, like you say, shorts that looks like his nuts could slip out.
Yeah.
But he's also set up as this kind of ridiculous figure as well, which I think makes their sort of like intense horniness towards him more interesting. I mean, he's introduced coming in on this tiny horse with his big thighs out, wearing a stupid hat, and like seeing him like drunk at Christmas, where like his face is all, his nose is red, and like he just looks like so unappealing. But because, I don't know, it's like the isolation, but also there's something that makes him more appealing because he is this mix of ridiculous and sexy.
I don't know. The scene where I forget what scene it is, but there's a scene of him with like the animals, and he's just drinking his tea, and he's with the creatures.
Yeah.
And he is just chilling, and it's before he like walks in on the nuns without his shirt on, and I'm watching this with no context, but I do recognize it's 1947. This is an English movie. like the fact that this man is barging in here with his shirt off is probably like kind of a big deal. But I laughed out loud whenever this man walked out, specifically that particular scene.
He's so funny. He's so like, yeah. You're right. He's like so kind of like infantile and childish and goofy. Mm. And there's like something there too about it that I think speaks to kind of that, like, I don't know, that sort of like inherent attraction to somebody, especially in a place that's kind of like devoid of options, yes, but someplace that's like, you know, so sort of like, what's the word I'm looking for? I guess kind of like sterile, and maybe almost like anemic in that way, you know, like this, you know, society of nuns, these women who are trying to keep something very kind of clean and holy. Mm. And this guy comes in and he's loud and he's ridiculous and he's a kind of a buffoon, but it's also like you're different. Like at least you have some sort of like you're tapped into something here that's present in this place of absence, you know?
And I do think that something that's interesting about both Sister Clodagh and Sister Ruth's attraction to him is like, obviously Sister Ruth's darkness is more apparent than Sister Clodagh's. Hers is more repressed, but it seems that they are attracted to his very darkness and his dirtiness and his, like, that he's such a defiled kind of figure. Like, both physically, he often looks kind of dirty and sweaty, but also, I mean, he's gross. I mean, the way that he talks about like having sex with the women in the village, with these young girls, I mean, he's like a bit of a pedophile. Like, and it seems like they are, that part of his appeal to them is this really dark kind of ugliness that is kind of magnetic towards them. I guess because it is the opposite of this ideal that they're trying it, like, impossibly to live up to, of, you know, pureness and holiness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's a component of this too that I feel like Ruth sees that connection between the two of them. She understands that darkness, and it's kind of one of the reasons why she feels that kinship, despite, you know, when she confronts him at the end, he's like, we've like never talked to one another.
Yeah.
And she's like, no, we have, though. We have talked to one another through our bodies, you know. But there's something here too that I get the sense that Dean is a character who recognizes in himself that sort of darkness, and recognizes sort of that need for something, and makes him more attracted to Clodagh. Like, it's almost like something about like her cleanliness, her, you know, her kind of pristine nature is what attracts him to her, as a way of validating maybe his, you know, gentler side that maybe he still believes he has intact, even though he's a little bit more kind of gruff and rough around the edges.
Yeah. And that cleanness, I think, is part of the, what's so interesting about Clodagh versus Ruth. And I think why Ruth is a sexier character is because, I mean, Deborah Carr, one of my favorite things every time I see her name is, apparently when they introduced her in Hollywood, they had this whole campaign where they're like, Deborah Carr, it rhymes with star. And so that was like where they would put in all the trades and stuff and like all the, like, you know, Hollywood magazines. Anyway, digression. But she looks like powdery throughout the movie. Like, she looks dry, you know? And Sister Ruth, like, she's wet throughout this
entire movie. She's
sweating
the whole fucking time.
I'm sure wet, you know, in many ways. But like, yeah, she's always glistening with sweat, like at the end in the doorway, like when her hair is like matted down to her head, like you see it like blowing in the wind, and it's like these like soaked strands of hair. Like, yeah, that sort of like physical difference between them. Like, I mean, she feels sexy because she feels embodied, you know?
Yeah, there, and like they play with that quite a bit within the, you know, context of the film, when Clodagh has kind of her like dark night of the soul, you know, where she stays up all evening, like standing by the cliff, and you know, has the young boy kind of come and like revive her and send her to bed or whatever afterward, is the first time we ever see her like powder dry sort of demeanor shift. Like she, and she has like a couple like little beads of sweat, and you're like, oh,
uh-oh.
This place is getting to you too. You're starting to get a little sweaty.
Oh, she does perspire. Look at this. Little Miss Plota. She can sweat. But yeah, and it's, I mean, the Ruth thing, I think her embodiment is also interesting because, like, you know, I was just saying that it's sexy that she's like sweaty and gross.
Yeah.
But I mean, they talk so much about like all of her bodily ailments. Like they have the scene early on where they're like, her joints ache and she's got spots and she's got a boil on her finger. And like,
yes.
We hear about, you know, all the nuns having these like physical manifestations and stuff. But I think it's interesting that with Deborah Carr's character, like they say she has spots on her arm, but like we never see any sort of indication of that. But like we hear constantly about like how fucked up like Sister Ruth's body is. Like even before they go, they're like, she's in bed because she's sick. And like, yeah, she's constantly having some sort of like physical ailment.
Yeah. They're afraid of it. They're afraid of her body, which you see in full force at the end when she kind of dons the dress and everything. And it's like, oh, I see. Mm-hmm. I see why you were scared of this.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, and like that. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Michael.
No, I was going to say, Shelley, I don't know what it is about you kind of breaking down like all of her ailments that makes me more attracted to her character.
Right?
I was like, oh, I love a mortal, you know? I love someone with something to complain about.
We say we like a girl that's a little broken, and I don't mean psychologically. I mean like physically, her body's failing all the time. You know?
Yeah, but I mean it's so true. It's like, I mean, I always like joke about how like I love when someone's got like a little bit of like a lazy eye or something, or I think it's like I love scars and stuff because like it's like it proves like you've got a body, you know?
Yeah.
Like that, it's so sexy to me. And like I love in the scene of her putting on the lipstick. I feel like in like a Hollywood movie of the era, if you see a pretty woman putting on lipstick, you would expect it to be like, you know, gauzy shot, like, you know, soft focus, her plump lips as she puts it on. But they get close up on her lips and they are dry. They are like kind of cracked, like, and so it's like it's still sexy, but like you see the flesh of it all. Like you see that, you know, the weirdly discolored, like.
Even like her facial expression during the application is very like trance-like.
Yeah, it's an ambulant almost. Yeah.
So fucking spooky. And it's,
and it's not like a perfect application either. I don't know if you guys catch this, but like, you know, she and obviously, you know, like we won't fault her for this. She's not doing it in a mirror or like anything, but when she puts it on, they allow it to be like a little bit crooked, you know, like a little bit like she's kind of like out of practice embracing this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And she kind of like has like a smear in like the corner of her lip a little bit. It's good. It's really good.
I love it. I don't know why.
Well, so you wouldn't, I mean, this is obviously not a horror film, but it has elements that feel akin to the things that you would see in horror films, especially the way that she is framed. So, I mean, what is it, Aaron, do you think that like makes people so attracted to villains, especially in these like sort of like horror contexts? Like, what is it that's so exciting about that?
I mean, I think it's the same thing that draws people to a lot of these kind of like horror characters. And I'm not gonna say like, you know, like killers or slashers or anything like that, but we do have, you know, people in society who have kind of like a fixation on people who are actual killers. I think it's something about the sort of way that they butt up against the repression of society that's kind of always there. And you know, some of these are sort of like de facto like social mores and like folk ways of existence, right? Like where we, you know, we don't swerve on the highway to like run into, you know, an oncoming car and try to hurt somebody and maybe ourselves, unless you're in a J.G. Ballard novel. Or a But even that, right, is about kind of like the digression from like the societal norm, from the ideas of sort of like the postures that we all carry and this sort of kind of natural facade and performance that we all put on as part of everyday life and existing among other people. And so when someone bears their ugliness for everyone to see and, you know, kind of walks in contradiction to those performances, it feels a little scary. It feels a little unsafe, but it also feels, I think, liberating watching somebody do that and being able to live vicariously through them, like in this case, a Sister Ruth.
And it does seem to be a well-established trope of the character of the unstable woman, and that it tends to have an edge of eroticism to it. That is, like, it's not just that she's crazy, it's that she's crazy and she's so horny. Like, you know, it's like a Misery or like a Single White Female or, you know, De Palma's Sisters, like that. Oh, there's yeah. always like a psychosexual component to a woman's madness, it seems. I don't know. It's interesting because I feel like a male character going mad, it will oftentimes have like a sexual component to it, but oftentimes it does seem like that is kind of sublimated into it being coded as queer. That so I don't know. There's something like naughty and strange about that I am always trying to kind of unpack there. You know.
Yeah, it's like I think there's just something about. And I'm going to step on this word very gently, but like the idea of like a deviance to like sexuality, right? And in a lot of films and in our society for a long time, like the expression of like homosexual eroticism has been like deemed, you know, by the censors as like deviant or cutting against sort of like the grain here. But in the case of women, often it is simply just like being able to like willfully and like unencumbered just express your sexuality. Like that is somehow, you know, like this sense of indiscretion and deviance when it comes to like the feminine object in films a lot.
Yeah, and I mean like in such a extreme way in this one, because it's like not only is she a woman, you know, expressing this sort of like, you know, deviant thing of, you know, feeling erotic feelings, but she begins as a nun. So it's like she takes the farthest journey to that you could possibly take. So you were a young cinephile, as you were like getting into these classic movies, like what were some of the films that you found kind of awakened your sexuality or like established your ideas of like what you found attractive, like either on film or just generally?
Oh boy. Like going all the way back to the beginning. Shall
sure.
I? I think I can't verify this, but I remember vividly my first on-screen crush being Alicia Silverstone in Clueless.
Classic.
Oh my God.
Who's a very different kind of like femininity, but she's like
a little bit.
Like very preppy, like very cute. Like I remember being 5 years old. And I remember like crying one night, telling my parents that I had a secret and I didn't want to share it with them. And that secret apparently was that at 5 years old, I understood that I was like very sexually attracted to Alicia Silverstone. I didn't have like a language for it or like an understanding of it, but like I remember it like confusing me to the point where I'm like, I don't want to talk to you all about this. Like, who do I talk to about this?
So
it must have been, very severe. That carried on through a lot of my youth, but let's see, I will tell you who I attribute with my like actual like serious boy girl feelings on screen. It's my number one like celebrity crush, has been for essentially all of my life since I was probably like 9-10 years old.
Oh wow. Long-term relationship.
Parker Posey.
Parker Posey, like even younger, like I think I saw her first in things like Waiting for Guffman, and then I saw her in like Dazed and Confused.
Yes.
And then later on in some of her other Christopher Guest stuff, Best in Show, what have you, as I was, you know, becoming like a teenager. And she was the first like woman that I was like attracted to, where I was like, this isn't a girl. Like, this is like, she's like a grown woman, you know, and like, so she's got funny. Like a face and like a severity, but also I don't know, just like an adultness to her. And I was like, I want to go to there like that. So it's always been Parker Posey for me for a long time now.
Is there one Parker Posey performance or even one moment that like for you is Parker Posey?
Oh boy. You know, it's one that I've only come to recently.
Okay.
Just in the last couple of years, I finally caught up with Greg Mottola's film.
Yes.
Which, oh my God, I'm blanking on the name now. It's not the Overnighters.
Yes. Yeah.
Right? Is that what it's called?
Yeah, I think so. Right?
I can't remember.
Oh, or Out of Towners?
No. Let me.
No.
Sorry, I'm gonna have to just like. Look at me doing this.
Yeah,
this
yeah, yeah. Go for it.
I was like, I want to get this. I want to get this right for you all. So
oh
you
yeah, have, right? Yeah. Especially because I think Greg Mottola has several films on the Criterion Channel right now, so we should yes. give people a chance to watch.
Greg Mottola's film, The Day Trippers.
Day Trippers. We were so close. Overnighters, Out of Towners, Day Trippers.
Overnighters is the documentary with the priest in North Dakota yes. who finds out he's gay.
Right.
Day Trippers is the movie with Parker Posey and Stanley Tucci and everyone. Anyway,
yes.
in that movie, she is like with Liev Schreiber's character. She's mm-hmm. a little bit kind of like hoity-toity. She's clearly like not super into him anymore. And she starts to like fall for this like older guy, this very like literary type who's like much more confident, much more kind of like sexually aware of himself and attracted to her and expressing that in ways that are meaningful. Mm-hmm. And there's a scene where she goes to a party that he's at. And she's able to get in, but Liev isn't. And she takes off like her jacket and like strips all of her like more refined clothes off until she's just in like a very tight black leather skirt and a pair of heels and like a black shirt or something. Mm-hmm. And it's like this is you. This is you just like moving from one thing, this like kind of very polished, very refined like idea of yeah. womanhood into like party girl mode. And you can do both of them and both of them are hot on you and you're perfect.
Oh, that's so good. Oh my gosh. What a perfect moment. Incredible encapsulation of her. Yeah, that movie. Oh, great. Sexy cast. Hope Davis. Ooh, she really does it for me.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Parker Posey was a big sort of inspiration for me as a teen because I watched a lot of Waiting for Guffman, especially her deleted scene of her monologue that she does for her audition. Yes. Michael, have you seen this monologue?
I have not.
Ooh, I am going to send it to you the minute we get off. It is a tour de force. It
oh,
is
shit.
Truly incredible.
Maybe there's something about her too in Dazed and Confused as just like the most ruthless cheerleader you've ever met, just like screaming at freshmen. Like what's her line when she says like wipe that head off your face, bitch,
yes.
or something like that? And I'm like, I want someone to talk to me this way. So maybe that's where like the start of my like evil woman attraction.
I was gonna say
starts.
This undercurrent of fear I'm sensing is very interesting.
It's very necessary.
So in more recent times, I admire your dedication to this long-term relationship with Parker Posey. But are there performances that you've seen in more recent years that you maybe wouldn't have recognized when you were younger as something that was attractive to you, but really stand out to you now?
Oh, man. Not of Parker Posey, just in general? Anybody?
Just in general, or, yeah. Because okay. I, it's funny, I've seen like my sort of interest in actors like develop over time. Because like I mean, when I was very young, I had a real obsession with like Ralph Fiennes. And now I'm like, oh, he's too pretty. And now everyone I like is like an old homunculus.
That's good to know. Okay. Yeah, I guess that's an interesting question. I mean, I have my like kind of standbys who are just like obsessions that I've always had, like a Linda Fiorentino.
Oh, yes.
Oh my!
We've talked about
God.
Previously
yeah.
on
we talk,
here.
We did, yeah.
but someone who I needed, I think, to grow up a little bit to truly appreciate. I saw her in Men in Black when I was like 7 years old, and
yeah.
clocked her as like a pretty person on a
yeah.
movie. But now I see her as like just the smolder is unreal. Like she
yeah.
like makes, she's so I mean, hot I want to die sometimes.
Yeah.
In After Hours, I want to fucking throw myself
oh my,
like
oh my
off
God.
A cliff.
Yeah. Well, you know, that I think is maybe a good segue then to one that's been more recent, who is Rosanna Arquette.
Yes.
Who I
oh,
was
perfect.
Never attracted to in my mm-hmm. entire life up until probably seeing After Hours within the last like 5 years and
yeah.
then seeing her in Crash and a couple other things. And so Rosanna Arquette is one for sure.
Oof.
And
she's good.
I guess my other big one is somebody who for a long time I found very kind of bothersome and have fallen in love with since starting the podcast, who is Juliette Lewis.
Interesting. Oh, why do you think that changed?
I attribute almost exclusively to finally seeing Kathryn Bigelow's 1995 film Strange Days.
Yes.
Both very good in and also like ungodly hot in, just like wearing next to nothing, covering PJ Harvey. And it's like, oh, okay. Like, why did I miss this? How did I not realize that this is incredibly sexy?
I don't know.
There was something about her, like, you know, she's certainly gorgeous, but she is a little bit, you know, kind of different looking and just maybe not to my particular sensibilities when I was younger, but now it's just like tour de force.
Yeah, I do find that, and I don't know if, Michael, you feel the same way, that certainly as I've gotten older, I've gotten more interested in, like, specificity. That, you know, people that when I was younger, I might have thought were, like, a little strange or a little off. Like, now that is the thing that I find most appealing about someone, is that they feel singular, you know?
Yep.
You know, Michael,
have you found that as well? Yeah,
I absolutely agree with this. I'm thinking about my attraction to Sandra Bernhard, and like other folks who just have a thing about them. Like, this whole conversation, I've been thinking about, like, Rachel Weisz has been, like, rolling around in my brain, specifically her performance in The Shape of Things, where she plays an evil woman, and she's she is so evil and calculating in such a specific way that I find it very attractive. But I guess, like, as I've gotten older, the way that I define what and who is attractive to me has definitely expanded. Like, I can't, like, really pinpoint it, but I'm thinking of actors like Alfre Woodard, who, like, I fucking love her, her whole vibe, but I cannot speak.
Well, she's always felt like a woman, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, you, I feel like, as a if you're too young, you can't appreciate Alfre Woodard, because she's a woman. You have to be ready for Alfre Woodard, you know?
Of course.
Yeah.
She's looked the same, by the way, for like 50 years now.
Oh, yes.
It's like unbelievable. So I was under the impression until very recently that Alfre Woodard was like maybe like late 40s, early 50s.
Yeah.
And then I put on the Alan Rudolph film, Remember My Name, which is from 1978. And she's a full grown, like 20 something, like maybe late 20 something woman.
What
in that
the
movie.
Shit?
Oh, and she looks crazy. The same, and I'm like, I cannot believe this. Like, okay, good for you.
Yeah, good 70 you. Years old. That is how old Alfre Woodard is. That is,
oh god,
absolutely insane. Black don't crack.
Black does not crack. It does not.
It's true. There's
it
a
is,
reason.
It is the truth.
The
We've heard
exists.
The rumors. It is the truth.
Yeah, she has looked amazing forever, and still does. It's wild.
Black don't crack, and neither does Kathy Bates. She's not black, but I think I think she's been aging very well.
And Kathy Bates, she's another one that, like, I feel like has aged into. I mean, she's always been good looking, I think, but I mean, she just has always felt like a woman, you know. So, like, as she gets older, it's like she feels even more like a woman, and that's very attractive, you know.
This is now making me think of actors that I'm not attracted to, like, in a popular way, but, like, as they've gotten older, I've become more attracted to them. Like, an example of that would be someone like Carrie Russell, who, like, hasn't really hit my radar until, like, I started to notice, like, oh damn, she in her 40s. Okay, what's up?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I want to talk to me when you're in your 60s. I want to know what's going on with that version of Carrie Russell. Ugh, aging. Love it.
And that is exciting, because, I mean, it is tough on actresses, I think, especially when, you know, you're a very young actress. There's such a narrow idea of what is attractive for a young actress and, like, what a young actress should be. Like, there's such emphasis on being the sort of ingenue that it is exciting to see a woman, like, age into her own. Though, you know, it then makes it, like, doubly depressing that there are so few roles written for women. over the age of 30. Yeah. I definitely felt that when I was, back in my acting days and I was auditioning for stuff. I was like, I'm not meant to be the 21-year-old girl in this, you know? That's just not, that's not my personality. That's not my look.
that's a real, real thing.
Yeah.
I felt the same, the exact same way. I was like, yeah.
We're supposed to be middle-aged.
We're supposed to be middle-aged. Like, I was like, I'm not going to hit till I'm like in my Morgan Freeman era. Like that's when, okay. That's when I'll know myself.
I recall recently somebody on Twitter like asking like why Susan Sarandon like hasn't been in enough erotic thrillers.
Yeah.
Because of how hot she is, and she is like, and mm-hmm. and she talk about aging well, yeah. like oh yeah. my god. but she found it and like quote tweeted, and she's like, "There's still time for that." And I was "Yes, please!" Like nothing would please me more than seeing like Susan Sarandon now doing like sexy like femme fatale role, because like that's my fantasy. Like I want ruin my life.
Right? Yo. That should be the title of the movie too. I want you to ruin my life, starring Susan Sarandon. I will watch the shit out of this movie.
Yeah, no one take this title. Michael, Aaron, and I are going to get off of here and start the screenplay.
Go work on it right now.
God.
Yeah. I have heard from people who like worked events that she was at that apparently she is just sucking on that vape pen all the time. That she is high.
I love her.
She is so cool.
Yeah, feature not bug. Feature not
exactly.
Bug.
She fucking rules. Well, so okay. Obviously, Black Narcissus, a singular film. However, we do like to ask if you were to recommend another movie to go with Black Narcissus, whether it's a double bill or if you're just recommending a movie to a friend who likes Black Narcissus, like here's something else you might like. What would be something you would pair with that? Michael, you want to start us off?
Oh God, I wasn't prepared to go first, but I will, because I think about this is my favorite thing to think about. So I wrote down like a bunch. I wrote down like fucking 90, but I'm gonna say three. Okay. The first would be Andrea Arnold's Wuthering Heights, 2011. Yes. Just the whole vibe of desire, longing, the natural world. Just like I remember watching that movie for the first time being like, damn, I want to fuck that grass the same way. The last shot of Black Narcissus makes me go, damn, I want to fuck that plant. So there's that. Then number two is a movie that I have not seen yet. And I queued it up immediately after I watched, Black Narcissus. And that movie is, The Color of Money. Which Martin Scorsese mentioned, you know, a lot of the close-up shots of Deborah Carr kind of inspired, and Kathleen Byron kind of inspired the way that he shoots the billiards players. And then the last, damn, I said I was going to do three, but I'm going to do four. It's a tie. It's a tie between The Ghost and Mrs. Muir, which came out 1947, same year. Very horny movie. Lots of restraint. Lady is horny for a ghost. They can't fuck. Similar to the way that these nuns cannot, fuck any of the plants. And then last movie, The Little Hours, 2017. Another movie about horny nuns.
Love it.
So ends my recommendations.
These are great. It is something that's always interesting to me is the difference in perception that like an artist has of their own work and how audiences might receive it. Because I did meet Andrea Arnold once and I told her how much I loved Wuthering Heights. And I said it was like, you know, maybe my favorite adaptation of it. And she was like, it sucked. I did a bad job on that one.
Which
is crazy to me.
No.
She was like, it didn't work.
Oh,
no, don't do that to yourself.
I know. I was like, lady, what? But you know, I thought that I was also... Yeah, I thought it was kind of inspiring, actually, because I was like,
cool.
This is something that I think is such a masterpiece in the fact that she's like, I could do better. I'm like, all right, that rules.
Yeah.
Well, Aaron, what would you pair with Black Narcissus?
This is a really good question. I have to ponder it for a little bit. It's going to be very obvious, but okay. If your listeners have not seen other productions by the Archers,
yes,
specifically the ones that they dabble in, Technicolor, mm-hmm. Matter of Life and Death, which they do just the year before this. Kathleen Byron is also in that as an angel. The Red Shoes, which is, as I've mentioned already, like maybe one of the most gorgeous, like mm-hmm. holy cinematic experiences I've ever had in my life. There is a centerpiece production of a ballet that is done like ground level on the stage with all of these immaculate set pieces that is dreamlike and hypnotic and unbelievable. Like, it just took my breath away as a young movie watcher. And then The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp is another one that I would recommend. If you have not seen Archer's movies, go watch Archer's movies. You see those arrows hit that target at the beginning of a movie, you know you're in good hands and going to have a good time.
Ooh, these are such good recommendations. God damn.
Watch them all. Watch them all. Eat them up. Some of them are a little long.
Blimp is very long. But it doesn't feel long. It moves. It moves really quickly.
It definitely does. And Red Shoes, too, I think is like up in like that 2.5 plus. But again, just the best time, you want to live in it. And then another recommendation I have, and I don't know why. Maybe it's because of just the palpable sensuality of every second of them. And because it also features one of my favorite stealth sex symbols, someone who I hadn't even thought about until right now, the great avant-garde filmmaker Maya Deren.
Yes.
And she has one of her very first short films is called Meshes of the Afternoon. It is brilliant and beautiful. She is formerly like a dancer as well as a career. And so she is someone who just has an incredible understanding of movement and physicality and just how to like manipulate a body in front of a camera for an audience. And you know, it's kind of bizarre. It's very dreamlike. Atland is another really good one that she did that followed this up, which is also just like you'll be mesmerized by its just kind of creativity and ingenuity with like kind of in-camera effects how she's manipulating things. But it's also just like looking at a beautiful woman sensually moving in front of a camera for like 20 minutes, is brilliant stuff.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think maybe one of my favorites of hers is Ritual in Transfigured Time. And I love the performance of Rita Cristiani in that. And just, it does have an interesting echoes of Black Narcissus, of like this woman in this sort of strange, off-kilter, dreamlike state of like confusion, but sensuality. Those are such good picks. I love this.
Thank you.
I hadn't thought about this until you were listing off all of the Archer's titles at once, but it is fascinating, this like through line they have of like impossible desire in their films, that like I hadn't thought about the fact that, like, I mean, in The Red Shoes, there's obviously that feeling of like the impossibility of her like achieving this desire of dance, it's not for another person. But then, you know, Matter of Life and Death, they're separated by death itself. You know, Colonel Blimp, they're separated by, you know, war, and the death of Deborah Carr's character. Like, I had never really clocked that sort of through line in their movies, but that's really interesting.
Not to spoil too much, but they also like to give people endings much like Sister Ruth's in this movie. Sometimes not as final, but like definitely something about the sensation of starting at point A to a lower point B in elevation is always on their mind.
That's so true. That's funny. That's great. So I guess for mine, I had two different ones because I took two sort of different tacks on why I would pair them. The first would be Fritz Lang's Metropolis. And that is because of the incredible production design in this film. Black Narcissus. So apparently a lot of the cast, like when they signed on to the film, thought that they were going to be filming like on location in India. They did not. They filmed on a soundstage. And what a soundstage it is.
God.
Apparently some people, you know, who had like lived in the Himalayas, like watched it and originally like thought that they had shot on location because of the like incredibly detailed work that they did of like blowing up like black and white photographs and then, you know, using like, I think chalk apparently to, you know, color in and create this like vibrant landscape behind them. My grandma told me a story when we watched the film State Fair when I was a kid, that she didn't realize that they were like painted backdrops on the sets. And she was on a date when she saw it. And the guy leaned over and he was like, you know, they painted that. And she was like pissed at him for the rest of her life. She was like, why'd you spoil it for me? But while it might have been a spoiler for my grandma, it is one of the pleasures of watching both Black Narcissus and Metropolis is like knowing that these are constructed sets and just seeing the artistry that goes into making these like incredibly convincing worlds. And then the other one, this is more on like a thematic level, is that I would pair it with Abel Ferrara's Bad Lieutenant, because it also has that, you know, like maddening push-pull between the sacred and the profane, between, you know, sensual life and, you know, God. Obviously, it manifests very differently in Bad Lieutenant, where he's, you know, downing vodka and ripping coke and, you know, fucking people he's arrested. Not fucking, raping. He's raping people.
Yeah, he's
right. Yeah. let's call it what it is. Yeah. So, yeah, that manifests slightly differently than, like, Sister Ruth putting on lipstick. But I find those sort of resonances of people sort of tortured by being stuck between God and earthly desires to be really interesting.
That's a good one. Sorry to not be totally familiar with your lore, but has anyone done Harvey Keitel on your show?
I don't somehow, think we have yet.
Somehow we've not talked about
Harvey
Keitel.
I think
Keitel
we've been saving Harvey Keitel.
We've mentioned Harvey Keitel a lot.
A lot. Which we also have a Harvey Keitel sound cue.
I'm not masturbating!
Yeah, yeah.
That is from, I think it's called the Gentleman's Club or the Men's Club.
Uh-huh. Yeah, he's very much in our little mini zeitgeist, but yeah. We're overdue to talk about this man, this
Harvey Keitel and his penis that is just always out.
He is a series of veins that made a wish to be a human man. Incredible being.
And just that meaty pork chop ass that's all over the piano.
Big hulking shoulders.
Like he is. I mean, he's very like he's well fed in the piano. Yes. I'll say. Like,
yeah.
He's good.
He's a strapping man. You know.
Yes. Of course.
Shelley, I'm gonna make a note that we gotta do like a bracket of meaty asses. To decide.
The ham hocks bracket.
The ham hock to rule them all. Like who's got it?
I'm down for it. Let's do it.
You gotta.
Oh my goodness. Well, we're running low on time, but every week we do like to finish out with a little game. And we're gonna be doing a classic this week. A classic fuck, marry, kill. However, the twist is this is fuck, marry, kill. Nun edition. So we have three nuns that we will be choosing between for this fuck, marry, kill. Our first is, of course, our beloved Sister Ruth from Black Narcissus. Number two is Dolores Van Cartier, Whoopi Goldberg's character from Sister Act. And number three is Sister Aloysius, Meryl Streep's character from Doubt. So, Michael, would you like to begin?
This is going to be the easiest one I've ever done. I have not seen Doubt, so I'm going to kill Sister Aloysius. Sorry. She's also the spookiest on my inverted screen. I'm seeing negatives of everyone, so everyone looks like a ghost. So there's that. I am going to marry Dolores because I think we would have a healthy musical marriage. We probably have the most to talk about you know, on a basic music level. Her whole vibe, like I love Whoopi, we all know this. That's like we got legs, we have wheels, we are gonna go the distance. And then I am going to fuck Sister Ruth. Oh my god. She is the exact type that I had once gone for in the past. Lord, and I don't, I god, she, that woman ruined my life. I probably ruined hers.
All right. There you go.
Yeah.
That's very mature. Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. You're welcome.
Aaron, how about you?
You know, I think I'm going to have to carbon copy Michael's answers. Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, I too have not seen Doubt, but I am a pretty staunch, like, I'll call myself a Meryl skeptic rather than a Meryl hater.
Not a streeper. Okay.
Yeah, not a streeper. But an easy one to off, I think, in this situation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think Whoopi is somebody, like you said, Dolores has kind of figured out a way to both embrace her holiness, embrace that kind of practice, while still having a little bit of fun, while still yeah. having energy, while still bringing the heat. So we could build in that, on that yeah. foundation, I think, a
synthesis.
Very solid relationship long term. And then absolutely, we're fucking Sister Ruth. It's I mean, with the caveat, I think that it's a long session, and you know, and like I said before, like the versatility of beauty here, she's hot in every iteration mm-hmm. in this movie. The nun situation, when she's like in the lipstick and the dress, and then when she like, you know, off the wall, like, you know, kind of goth batty crazy at the end, like mm-hmm. all of those sound like a fun experience.
Oh,
I'd like
yeah.
to experience the breath of them. All I'm going to say about that.
I like it. I mean, honestly, I set myself up for this. You know, we like to have a fuck, marry, kill where there's going to be some contention and some argument, but there's no way to do it any other way, you know? You got to fuck Sister Ruth, obviously. You know,
yeah.
you start with her in the habit, you take pieces off, let's keep going, going, going. It's going to be great. Ooh, but she
keep
is
the
one
habit
that...
on.
Ooh, see, I think start with the habit mm-hmm. and then, you know, like you said, she's great in all different iterations. So I want a taste of everything. But then you make sure you block her number afterwards.
Oh yeah,
because you are in for a world of trouble. And definitely have to marry Whoopi. Obviously, we love Whoopi. You know, absolutely charming, absolutely beautiful in that movie. And I have seen Doubt, and I will say, fucking kill Sister Aloysius. She sucks ass.
Oh.
She fucking sucks. Kill her. So yes, I think we are all in agreement. I think this is beautiful. But thank you so much for coming on today, Aaron. Thank you for playing Fuck, Marry, Kill and for sharing your horniness with us. We are so grateful. Could you tell the listeners where they can find you?
Of course. So I am the co-host, along with my partner Carly, of a show called Hit Factory. And we are a podcast about the films of the 1990s. But rather than do that with kind of a rosy-hued nostalgic lens, we like to kind of undermine that. We kind of we like to advertise ourselves as an anti-nostalgia podcast often and get into more of the kind of sociopolitical context of the time and the era in which a movie is made, the things that are reflected within the work that speak to that time and place, and also talk about the material reasons why maybe, just maybe, movies were a little bit better back in the 90s than they are in the current cinematic landscape. So that's available wherever you stream podcasts. We're online at Hit Factory Pod. That's also my personal Twitter account. I just tweet from there. I get a little flippant with it sometimes. Sorry in advance if you're looking for just like straight marketing materials.
That's what everyone's looking for, right?
Right.
I love marketing.
You just want to be advertised to sometimes. You'd be surprised the number of people who are like, your podcast account, why are you saying this or talking this way? It's like, because I'm also a human being. It's like,
yeah.
Nerd! Dork. I usually just send them like a gif of like someone getting a wedgie or something. But we're also on Patreon, patreon.com/hitfactorypod, where we do biweekly bonus content. So the full Hit Factory experience is available there for a very slight subscription fee monthly.
Amazing. Yeah. Oh. Listeners, give them your money. Go. Ooh. Go subscribe.
I cannot wait to subscribe. I have one quick question. Do you talk about Deep Cover at all?
We do indeed. We talk about Deep Cover a lot.
Yes.
Carly and I did an episode on that one, I think just back in March.
Okay.
We love it. We're obsessed with that film. Bill Duke, the god. Fishburne,
yes.
the god. Goldblum, the god. And then we also had the absolute pleasure of getting a chance to host and introduce that film at a screening here in town at our local draft house shortly thereafter. So we have spent a lot of time thinking about Deep Cover and preaching the good word of that film.
Oh, that rules. Oh, my God.
All right, I'm starting with
that. I can't wait for us to talk about this.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Well, Michael, where can people find us?
Y'all can find us everywhere at Everyone is Hot Pod. That's every number one is Hot Pod. And wherever you're listening to our show, rate us 5 stars. If you don't, we'll push you off a cliff.
off the bell tower you go.
Yeah, we will push you right off.
And we won't even look hot doing it.
Yeah.
We won't even put on lipstick and a slutty little dress.
We'll be so fucking dry. Yeah. You won't believe how dry
our powder will be set. You will not see our hair. Well, and what is the most important thing for people to do?
Oh, remember, listeners, stay horny.
Horny, darling.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Want to get a chiseled look in the jawline? Sculpt and shape your jawline with added volume from Juvederm Volux XC. Juvederm Volux XC is an injectable gel specifically designed to be robust enough to improve moderate to severe loss of jawline definition. And it is the first and only hyaluronic acid filler approved for the jawline. Add volume to your jawline for a chiseled look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you. Visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.